Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we're going to be talking about U.S.-NATO hostility in Ukraine and the Black Sea. And our guest is Eric Dreitzer. And when we come back from this very short music break, I'll let Eric tell you about himself. Eric's from StopImperialism.com. Eric Dreitzer, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me, Cindy.
Well, I've been on your show, but I think this is probably the first time you've been on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Yeah, it is. And it's my pleasure to be on with you. I always look forward to hearing from you, always look forward to your analysis. It's always some of the best. So thank you.
Well, and yours too, even though we could be in better contact. I just, you know, want you to know that I read your stuff and I know you're still working and I know you're still out there. And especially in what's happening in Ukraine between the United States and Russia. So that, and we were talking before it started, before we started the interview, about how significant these things are that get very little attention. But before we get into that, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, the ones who may not be familiar with, you know, who you are and your work.
Sure. Well, I'm an independent geopolitical analyst. My website is stopimperialism.com. Although I focus on geopolitical issues, I kind of have my finger on a lot of different areas, you know, social justice and the peace movement and, you know, U.S. imperialism generally, wars and all of that fun stuff. So, I write a lot of articles. My work is regularly featured in Counterpunch, in New Eastern Outlook, RT. I make frequent appearances on RT, on Press TV, Alitasia, and a few other outlets as well. I also just recently launched a new show in partnership with the folks over at Counterpunch. It's Counterpunch Radio. It's a podcast that we're hosting through Counterpunch's website. So I have a lot of different things going on, but all of my work can be found on my website at stopimperialism.com.
Well, I'll talk to you a little bit later or off the air about maybe getting your podcast linked at the Soapbox People's Network, because we're putting a lot of different podcasts and stuff up there too, not just Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. But anyway, Eric, you wrote recently an article called Battlefield Black Sea. And I just, first of all, I think that talking about this stuff as an empire, you know, the U.S. is an empire, and social justice is an economic justice and environmental justice and sustainability is so intricately linked together. We can't, and that's why it's so good to say, you know, stop imperialism. Because it doesn't just focus on a narrow kind of issue. If we are anti-empire, then you must be anti-Democrats and Republicans, not just against Republican war.
Oh, that's exactly right. And I think, Cindy, you know, that's one of the reasons why you and I have connected so well on a lot of these different issues, because, you know, when we're talking about imperialism, we're talking about an imperial establishment. This is a political establishment, a political system, and an economic system that is not determined, not specific by blue ties and red ties, by men and women, by, you know, corporation this and corporation that. It's one large system with interlocking parts that are intricately, you know, interwoven and interdependent. And so when you're talking about an issue such as U.S. warmongering against Iran, you have to understand how that's connected to economic machinations, how that's connected to the global dollar system, how that's connected to proxy conflicts against Russia and China. All of these things are definitely interconnected, and that's kind of part of the reason why I call it, you know, the empire, why we call it imperialism, and why I shy away from simply talking about stopping this war or stopping that war, but focusing broadly on stopping imperialism.
Well, before we get into the issue, I'm already annoyed about the 2016 presidential elections, and they're like, I don't know how, a year and a half away from now. It just, to me, it's just like, okay, what is happening? And I'll get your take on this. What is happening, I think, is the establishment is choosing the candidates for the people to vote for. And so it doesn't matter if it's going to be Clinton versus Bush. And now we got the Bernie Sanders kind of Black Agenda Report said that he was like sheep herding for the Democratic Party, like Dennis Kucinich has done before him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what is your take on all of this already? I'm getting a headache from it. And it, like I said, it's 18 months away.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I'm on the same page. I don't really buy into these so-called elections, which I think, as you're implying, are really more selection processes than anything. And it's, I think, the only real reason to pay attention to it is to sort of follow the money, and it's to follow where Wall Street is hedging their bets, who Wall Street is supporting, how this is all working, and what we can glean from this, not because we think that one candidate or the other candidate's really going to make money much of a difference, but rather to try to be able to anticipate the course of events. And I think that, you know, back in 2008, this was something that I learned firsthand and following that election, because unlike most of the people that I knew at the time who were, you know, lauding the coming of the Obama Messiah, right, I wasn't really buying it. And I was seeing that the establishment, which had lined up behind Hillary Clinton, was shifting over to Obama. And I sort of had an inkling as to what that meant. But I think that in many ways, at least for me, that was a real important learning experience. And now, you know, 7-8 years later, as you watch this charade that they call an election process happening, I mean, you're seeing a very similar outcome. You're seeing the establishment lining up behind one or two candidates. I mean, first of all, let's put aside the absurdity of the fact that we're looking at yet another Clinton-Bush situation. I mean, that alone is already absurd. But beyond that, I mean, you're talking about the murderer of Gaddafi. You're talking about the one who trampled on his not yet cold corpse. And you're talking about Bush, who has just recently justified the Iraq war, if it can be believed. And so, I mean, this is the state of politics in the U.S. and the empire. And I think that for our purposes, for those people who are interested in justice and in peace and these type of issues, it's more a matter of paying attention to what the empire is thinking rather than to what is actually going to change. Because the reality is, nothing will change.
Right. And whoever wins, there's a certain segment of the population that will win, and then most of us will lose. So here we're set up to fight each other. Already people calling me all kinds of names because I'm not jumping on the Bernie bandwagon. So here we are fighting each other. And then, and I really think that's what the establishment wants us to do, is to be so divided along you know, stupid lines that we're not noticing how much they're stealing from us.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's, I'll point back to someone who I know you admire tremendously, who you had the great privilege of meeting, Hugo Chavez, mm-hmm. who, although he had, you know, nice diplomatic words for Obama when Obama came into the presidency, I think that one thing that he always reiterated over and over again was the Yankee Empire and what the empire was doing. He wasn't really talking about what the White House was doing. He was talking about what the empire was doing. And I think that that was because he had an understanding that this was a system, and that even if Obama was a good person, which of course I don't buy at all, but let's just assume you believe that, mm-hmm. even if that were the case, that didn't change the fact that the empire was going to do what the empire was going to do. And so taking that analysis, I think, is important when you look at, for instance, the situation in Ukraine, you look at the situation in Iraq and in Syria and really all over the world, that the empire, that this march of war, these global wars, this proxy wars, they're all going to continue. Obama's going to slide his way out of the White House. The next slime ball will scoot their way in, and this will continue.
Right. And that's why I think that, you know, you mentioned Hugo Chavez, and I see a lot of very encouraging and exciting things happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. They're actually uniting together against the U.S. empire. And it's like very effective. And I think if people really want to have true change, that we could look at what's going on down there and support that and join in those efforts. We could do it just locally and in our own states to try to just undermine and collapse the empire instead of like getting so caught up in these stupid elections.
Yeah, absolutely. Although at the same time, I think that Latin America is a perfect example of the way in which the empire, for, you know, if one could excuse the unnecessary pun, you know, the way in which the empire strikes back in the sense that, in the sense that, I mean, look at the destabilization that they're trying to pull off in Venezuela. Look at the destabilization in Brazil with manufacturing these protests against Dilma Rousseff. Look at the destabilization in Argentina against Cristina Fernandez's government trying to implicate them in this assassination of an intelligence official. I mean, you see similar things happening in Ecuador as well. You see attacks against Ortega in Nicaragua. So the empire, along with its lackeys in each of these countries, the comprador, bourgeoisie, whatever you want to say, right. I mean, this class in each of these countries is trying to fight back against this anti-imperialist trend that you're talking about. And so in many ways, the fight is very much in Latin America. And really, I would say that's true of the entire global south. I mean, we've seen the same thing happening in many parts of the world. And one of the reasons why Russia and following this situation in Russia is important is not because everyone has to agree with the politics or economics of Russia. I certainly don't, as far as my, you know, ideological perspective goes. But understanding that Russia is a country that they've attempted to do the similar thing and they're failing miserably. Any destabilization against Russia has failed. Trying to suck them into a proxy war in Ukraine has failed. Trying to provoke and escalate the situation in the Baltic and in the Black Sea, this is also failing. And what you're seeing now is a developing alliance between Russia, China, and a number of other countries that is not only a way of striking back against the imperial machinations, it's changing the face of global politics and geopolitics for the next, you know, let's say, century.
Well, let's talk about that. How do you see it, affecting the power structure in the geopolitical arena? One thing that happened recently that you're the only person, one of the only people I saw that really talked about it, was that Obama refused to go to the Victory Day in Moscow recently, and first of all, Russia suffered the most loss during World War II. They certainly were very important in beating whatever we want to say. You know, it's really hard. It's really hard to talk about things in a way that you want to talk about the true history. And, you know, frame it in a way that we don't support war and killing tens of millions of people. But the Soviet Union was very significant in World War II in helping the United States and Great Britain beat the Nazis and fascism, whatever. I'm just going to use those terms. And then Obama, like, totally snubbed that their recognition day.
Yeah, and I think that Obama snubbing Victory Day in Moscow was really a diplomatic move. I think an incredibly boneheaded one, quite frankly, because there's very little benefit for Washington, for the Obama administration, in doing that, other than, you know, really childish sort of, you know, turning of the back at this moment. But there is an important symbolic significance, because there were countries there. And most importantly, China was there, and India was there, and Venezuela was there, and many other countries that we could consider to be outside of the imperial establishment, outside of the imperial system, whether they're in the global south or not. And I think that this is important, because it, what you're seeing then is an alliance, if not an overt alliance, certainly a tacit one, that's emerging between all of these countries that refuse to accept the diktats of the United States and the Europeans, the U.S., NATO machine. And I think that this is important. I mean, this is the first time that you've seen Chinese troops on parade on in Red Square. Oh. I mean, that is something that you'll look back on in 20, 30, 40, 50 years as a watershed moment, as a moment in which that long legacy of the Sino-Soviet split and the traditions of Russian-Chinese enmity towards each other, when that really began to fade away, and this Russia-China alliance became more than just one of economic convenience, it became one of political and military necessity. And I think that this is important, not only because the empire is driving the world to the brink of yet another world war, but also because it signals a tremendous shift in the, you know, the, to borrow Brzezinski's terminology, in the grand chessboard, because you are seeing the decline of the dollar system. You're seeing the rise of new alternative economic and financial instruments. You're seeing the rise of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is dominated by Russia and China. The rise of BRICS. The BRICS Development Bank is a rival to the IMF. The Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank is a rival to the World Bank and the IMF. All of these institutions. And of course, ALBA. We can't forget ALBA in Latin America, which also represents a move away from this imperial dominance. And so Victory Day, in many ways, I think, was a culmination of a lot of these processes, and really a symbolic moment when the world sat up and took notice that, you know what, in fact, it's the United States and the Europeans who have isolated themselves, not Russia and China.
Well, and then the last time I was in Venezuela, well, not the last time I was in Venezuela, but it's when Hugo Chavez was still alive and very vibrant. I talked a lot with the foreign ministry, and they were at that time developing a very significant relationship with China. And I think the U.S. wouldn't give a crap about Venezuela if it wasn't sitting on the biggest oil reserves in the world. And it's significant because, you know, I think these struggles are for domination of resources, and China needs resources too.
Absolutely right. I think that's 100% accurate. I also think that part of the reason why they have a particular hatred for Venezuela is because that Venezuela also represents a symbolic resistance. It's a resistance against capitalism, against global capitalism, against the consensus of capitalism. It's a resistance against U.S. imperialism in its quote-unquote traditional backyard, you know, according to the Monroe Doctrine and so forth. So there's a number, I think, of symbolic reasons. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, the oil is central. And as I already said, I mean, people who understand the basics of global economics know that oil and the dollar are inextricably linked. I mean, the dollar is not backed by gold. The dollar is not really backed by hard assets, but in many ways, it's backed by oil, the petrodollar. And so not only control of the oil itself, but having strategic alliances with these countries that are sitting on the oil, or conversely, being able to destabilize those countries that, you know, are sitting on the oil. This is part of the U.S. strategy. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of that, not only in the Middle East, but also in Venezuela. And then, of course, Russia is the number one gas supplier to Europe. And even continued despite all of the sanctions. The Europeans understand perfectly well just how dependent they are on Russia, and whatever bluff and bluster they might have about diversifying their energy sources and all of the rest of this, the games that they're trying to play with regard to pipelines and all of that, at the end of the day, German manufacturing is what drives the European economy, and German factories are dependent on Russian gas. That is an important point, and that is part of the reason why you have so much resistance against this drive by the U.S. to continue extending sanctions against Russia, because they fear tremendously the long-term impact that that can have on the European economy. And part of the reason that they see their leverage slipping away is they see Russia turning to China and looking to China to supply gas for China's growing economy. So all of these things are, you know, as we said at the top of our discussion, Cindy, you know, all of these things are totally linked together. And you can't look at each one in isolation. You have to see them as a comprehensive whole. Certainly the Russians see it that way. Certainly the strategic planners and the imperialists in Washington do as well.
Well, you know, I'm a child of the Cold War, and I've talked about this and written about it so many times. You know, we were diving under our desks once a week at the appointed time, you know, 2 o'clock every Friday, the air raid signals would go off and we'd be diving under our desks. And, you know, this is something that very few people talk about, but it seems to me like it has the most, it could have the worst consequences of anything that the empire is doing right now. And what I see is that the U.S. and NATO are doing war preparations, and they're doing their little games and stuff like that. And if Russia does anything in response in its own border, then they talk about Russia's becoming aggressive. Look at all this aggression. So talk about the buildup of the military in the U.S. military and NATO. And really, the NATO is the U.S., really. You know, it is part of the empire. It's not, you know, something that's independent of, you know, U.S. global domination. So talk about this big military buildup in that area.
Well, absolutely. And so if you look at the broad outline of this, you know, the trajectory of this conflict in Ukraine, people point specifically to, you know, February of 2014, when you had this violent overthrow of the Ukrainian government, this putsch in Kyiv, which the United States sponsored and allowed them to install their hand-picked puppet government, which continues to rule that country today. And in the immediate aftermath of that, you saw moves by Russia to secure their military assets, particularly in Crimea. And what happened was that the Russians backed an initiative in Crimea that voted for not only independence from Ukraine, but reunification with Russia. And I say reunification because, of course, Crimea was part of Russia historically during the time of the Soviet Union, an administrative move in which they gave it from Russia to Ukraine, which at the time was kind of more of a formality than anything, but obviously had important strategic significance because half of Russia's navy is based in the city of Sevastopol in Crimea. And so what happens then is that the Russians look at a U.S.-backed color revolution that overthrows a government and installs a fascistic government in its place, precisely in the country where half of their navy is based. And this is all happening within a matter of weeks of each other. At the same time, the Russians and the Russian military saw U.S. warships entering the Black Sea, multiple warships engaging in military exercises and drills. All of this is happening right at the same time in March of last year, March of 2014. And so the Russians obviously made a calculated move to secure their naval assets. And I think that this is critical because Russia, if anybody wants to look at a map, can understand Russia is severely limited as far as their naval access, particularly to warm water ports. And the Black Sea is absolutely significant to them, as it has been for over two centuries. And that's why the Russian Navy has been based in Crimea. And that's part of the reason why the Russians moved so quickly to secure Crimea. Now, in the West, the Western propaganda machine immediately goes into overdrive talking about Russian imperial expansion, which, I mean, can imagine the hypocrisy of the empire Empire, exactly. Talking about Russian imperialism. Yeah. But in any event, you know, they talk about Russian imperial aggression against Crimea, completely leaving out the fact that that is on Russia's border, that this is Russia's direct national security interest and Russia's military interest. On the flip side, what is the U.S. military doing in the Black Sea? What is NATO doing in wargaming scenarios for an invasion of Russian territory? I mean, all of this is happening at the same time, and none of it is discussed. And so you have MSNBC to Fox News, Democracy Now to whomever else, all talking about Russian aggression in right. Crimea, leaving out the fact that it's the United States and NATO that's pushing right up against Russia's borders. And the same is true throughout Eastern Europe. You know, remember the Bush administration talking about the so-called missile shield in Eastern Europe to prevent against quote-unquote rogue states. Originally, they talked about Iran and setting up this missile shield to protect Europe. Absolute nonsense. Putin said very clearly in 2007, this is an aggressive military system aimed at Russia. He was right then. He remains right today. The U.S. is pushing against Russia's borders throughout the former Soviet bloc countries. The same is true in the Baltics. You have massive NATO military escalation in Lithuania, in Latvia, in Estonia, all along the Baltic, moving assets towards Sweden, which isn't even a NATO member, moving assets towards Norway, all of this pushing closer and closer to Russia. Now, real quickly, I know we're somewhat limited on time, but I just want to point out, at the end of the Soviet Union, in the late 80s, and when George H.W. Bush was president, there was an agreement that was reached between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union that they would, that the Soviets would back off on the Berlin Wall as long as NATO agreed not to expand eastward. As soon as the Soviet Union collapsed, NATO began marching further and further eastward, consuming Poland, consuming the Baltic states, consuming many of the former Eastern European Soviet bloc countries. And Russia was so weak at that time that it really couldn't do anything. And I think one of the tragic examples of that is Yugoslavia and the destruction of Yugoslavia, a traditional Soviet ally. You see all of that happening over the course of a decade and a half. And now Russia is stronger and Russia says no. And Russia drew a red line in Ukraine. And that is really the situation that we're looking at now. And the United States and the empire in many ways is getting more aggressive and more belligerent because its options are fading away.
It's just, what do you, I just can't, it's just hard to wrap my head around how, who is pushing for this, Eric? Who is pushing for increased hostilities between really the countries that do have the massive amounts of nuclear weapons and well, of course, the U.S. is the only country that's actually ever used them. But, I mean, who's driving this? Who would it benefit?
Well, you have a couple of different factions that have power in Washington, and I don't like to draw too many lines between them as if they're really opposing each other. In many ways, there's a consensus. I call it an imperial consensus in Washington, but slightly different interpretations of it. On the one hand, you have a faction represented broadly by somebody like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has always seen that Russia is the great threat to American hegemony, and he wrote about it famously in his book, The Grand Chessboard, in 1997.
Well, and that's what the Afghan thing, was about, was Brzezinski, and it was about that proxy war against the Soviet Union that really was what made the Soviet Union collapse.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, to bring it to a more, slightly more contemporary example, the United States was deeply involved in fomenting terrorism in Chechnya and in the North Caucasus throughout the 1990s. And we know that because Brzezinski is close friends with one of the main leaders of the so-called rebel government of Chechnya of the 1990s. He sponsored him coming to Washington. He wrote the foreword to his book, for God's sake. So Brzezinski is very close to those those networks that have been waging terrorist war against Russia for years now. So you have the Brzezinski clique, and they're, you know, more or less associated with the Democratic establishment and certainly close to Obama, right, and have been for a long time. And then on the flip side, if it's possible, you have even the crazier crazies, the neocons, mm-hmm, who, of course, we all know the neocons and George Bush. We know how closely they're associated with Jeb Bush's campaign. It's all the same suspects, the Wolfowitzes and the Cheneys and all of these types. They're all still involved. And these guys are even more, and I think one of maybe the one that people really need to know is Robert Kagan, who's really one, yes, of the main architects of all of this. And he is, of course, married to Victoria Nuland, who is one of the main instigators of the situation in Ukraine. And so these people, they don't have allegiances to Republicans and Democrats. Yes. They move smoothly between these parties. It's very easy for them. But anyway, the point is the neocons are even more belligerent, even more aggressive. They say that Obama's posture against Russia is weakness, that he should, right, be more aggressive towards Russia, that he should be literally threatening war against a nuclear power. Now, if you can imagine the insanity of that, on from our perspective, it almost is difficult to fathom how anybody could think that way. But if you put yourself in their perspective, I think it makes perfect sense. They see the empire waning. They see U.S. hegemony collapsing around them. The Bush administration was one of the main precipitators of that collapse of U.S. hegemony. You saw U.S. reputation, U.S. power weakening all over the world, and you see the rise of China and the rise of Russia. So for their purposes, they say, well, we need to bring it to a conflict, and we need to do it quickly while we still can, while we can use that kind of a conflict to prop up the dollar, to send shocks through the global oil markets, to destroy those countries that are dependent upon the upon oil in many ways, and Russia being the primary example of that. So all of these geopolitical moves, these strategic moves that they're making, I think it's geared towards creating, drumming up a conflict in order to legitimize and perpetuate and expand U.S. imperial hegemony for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more decades, for another century. That's how they see it.
Well, and then, you know, we do have a few minutes left. I'm just really disheartened, Eric, and I have been, as you know, since Obama's become president. Well, even before then, you know, when the Democrats took, you know, majority back in Congress, the abdication of the so-called left in this country to, you know, and that's why Obama's president, because first of all, you have the liberals who support democratic wars, or if they don't support them, they don't oppose them. And then, you know, you have the people who might want to oppose what Obama's doing, but then it would be racist to do so. So you really have an abdication of who would traditionally be against military aggression. We know there's no checks and balances in our so-called government, but, you know, then there's not even the people out there making a stink or being really loud against this military aggression.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's I think two different things here. On the one hand, there are certain movements that do exist, but what they don't have important, significant backing. That's the issue, right? Because look, I know you were central in all of this. I mean, you know better than anybody how the left, so-called left, is controlled by foundation funding, how the left is controlled by very powerful and wealthy oligarchs whose money it's entirely dependent on, how they control many pseudo alternative media outlets that would traditionally be, you know, rallying points for the left, for an anti-war movement, for an economic justice movement, for all of these things. These things don't exist because there are no institutions around which they can really be built. And so instead, it's like the grassroots entirely diffused all over the country, entirely demoralized, having no real backing. lacking, having no cohesive structure, and quite frankly, in my opinion, also having no revolutionary understanding, having no revolutionary ideology. You know, they're afraid to talk about issues like capitalism. They're afraid to talk about systemic issues that I think are fundamental to building a cohesive movement with some level of solidarity. And so I remember, of course, during the Bush years, you had all of these liberals, all of these so-called progressives who would stand next to you at these protests, and you felt like, you know, we were really standing in opposition to something. I remember the protests against the Iraq War in 2002, when it hadn't even happened yet. In 2003, millions of people in the U.S. and around the world out into the streets. It changed nothing. As that presidency went on, as that war went on, it changed nothing. And then what happens? Obama comes along, the Democratic machine is activated, and all of them, one by one, drop away. And then you're standing there, and you realize that that person standing to your left and standing to your right, they're not there anymore.
Right.
And then you ask yourself, well, how come? What happened? And then you realize that all of them have become warmongers themselves. As soon as a Democrat gets into office, especially one who with a nice smile and a nice image, all of a sudden they're justifying drone killings. They're justifying a war on Libya. They're justifying proxy war in Syria. All of these liberals.
ISIS. What are we supposed to do about ISIS?
Yeah. Well, exactly. And more to the point, not only did Bush create ISIS, Obama's the reason, and Obama's policies in Syria is the reason that ISIS even exists today.
Right.
So, you know, the whole point is that the warmongering, the imperial aggression, all of these are the reasons why all of these problems exist. It's not because, you know, and quite frankly, and I mean, I don't mean to sound too fatalistic about all of it, but quite frankly, even during Occupy, even when you had a grassroots movement developing, or Black Lives Matter, or any of these, you know, movements that are, you know, nascent in many ways, what can they ultimately achieve against this system? You need to have global solidarity. There has to be a global anti-imperialist, anti-colonial understanding, and until such time as that exists, there will be no substantive change. Until people in America identify more with oppressed people in Latin America and oppressed people in Africa and oppressed people in Asia and throughout the world, until that happens and until they get their minds right about these issues and their own role and their own complicity in all of these imperial crimes, until that happens, there's not going to be any change.
Well, right. I mean, exactly. And, you know, you said that people here don't have the left or the liberals, they don't have a revolutionary understanding. And I think that most of the people I'm still in contact with now are pretty, you know, pretty smart. And they probably more than anybody else have that. But then someone like Bernie Sanders, and I'm just going to rag on Bernie Sanders, he comes along and says, we need a revolution in politics. And they say, oh, Bernie Sanders said revolution. Oh, yay. But what he means is that what Bernie Sanders really means by a revolution in politics is support me in the primaries. And then when I lose, then we'll support Hillary Clinton. How is that a revolution?
It's most certainly not. And in many ways, he's just Bernie Sanders' role, just as you said. I mean, his role is to hold up the left flank of the imperial consensus. That's all. You know, he's there to hold up the left flank, and he'll get his, you know, he'll get his nice little payday, his cushy position at the end of this. He'll write his book. He'll go on his tour. He'll do whatever he needs to do to be the principled leader of the progressive left, or whatever the hell they want to say about him. But quite frankly, I mean, look, Bernie Sanders, ultimately, he could call himself socialist in his younger days, and that's fine. Take a look at YouTube videos and see what happens when Bernie Sanders is confronted about the issue of Palestine.
Absolutely.
See what happens when Bernie Sanders is confronted about a number of key issues, and he has absolutely not a revolutionary bone in his body, not a true socialist bone in his body either. So, quite frankly, I find the entire discussion about Bernie Sanders to be somewhat ridiculous. But again, I mean, this is a, you know, fool me 758 times, shame on me situation. You know what I mean?
That's
I mean,
the, I, yeah.
they're They're going to be fooled over and over and over and over again. And I think the reality is, and this is, I think, in my mind, at least the main point, is that they're going to be fooled again because they want to be. That's what it comes down to. They want to be deceived. They want to be fooled because it's much easier to back an individual than to step back and say, these are systemic problems. And until we organize ourselves to tackle these systems, that is to say, the imperial system, the capitalist system, all of these systems, until we have a cohesive strategy and a revolutionary and ideological strategy to do that, we are hopeless.
Well, to me, a Bernie Sanders political revolution is about as significant as an IHOP pancake revolution or something like that.
Or so, a Ron Paul revolution.
Right, exactly. So, Eric Dreitzer, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And you are from stopimperialism.com. And you said something so significant. We need to identify and be in solidarity with oppressed people around the world if we want anything to change.
That's absolutely right. The global South is where the change will come from. Forget this idea that it's going to be first world white people who are going to lead to global salvation. That's not going to happen. Connect yourself to people around the world and understand that it's one struggle for all of us.
Well, Eric, we'll link your article and your website. And again, hope we can get you on the Soapbox People's Network, and we'll talk about that and see if we can make that happen.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Cindy. Always a pleasure.
Have a wonderful weekend.
You as well. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for this week. As always, I hoped you were informed and inspired. And I hope you go to stopimperialism.com. And as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank Eric Dreitzer for his work and for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.